Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Since sexual assault and harassment charges have come out against film mogul Harvey Weinstein, there's been an outpouring of other similar charges against male entertainment figures, journalists, and politicians. Most recently, comedian Louis C.K. has admitted to masturbating in front of non-consenting women, and Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore has been accused of sexual improprieties with a 14-year-old girl dating back 30 years. And at least since the outing of Bill Cosby as an alleged serial predator and the dismissal of Fox News chief Roger Ailes and the Donald Trump tape where he brags about grabbing women by the genitals, sexual harassment has been a major topic of national conversation. So is what's happening the purges of the last vestiges of the old patriarchy, or is it a long-delayed equalizing of the sexes that has barely gotten started? And is there a risk that in calling out rapists and criminal actors that a new puritanism will arise that essentially criminalizes workplace banter and romance? To discuss this, I'm talking with Kathy Young, a contributing editor to Reason and many other publications. She's a columnist at Newsday. She's been writing about gender since the 1990s and is the author of the important book Ceasefire: Why Women and Men Must Join Forces to Achieve True Equality. Kathy, thanks for talking to the Reason podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start by talking about Louis C.K. And now he's a comedian who was known for his dark humor, which was often about sexual themes and often about his own kind of proclivities and maybe perversion. I guess when he was doing stand-up, it wasn't perversion. It was funny. When it comes out that he was he's been accused and has admitted to basically masturbating in front of women who have not given their consent. He wrote a long apology in it where he kind of took responsibility for everything. What do you think of his apology note and the story around him?
I thought the part about his apology note that I found really odd, and by the way, I will preface this by saying that, you know, I applaud him for admitting to what he did and, you know, admitting that those women are telling the truth, and, you know, not trying to smear his accusers and so on. At the same time, the thing that I found really odd was his claim that he thought it was okay because he asked first. He doesn't say, by the way, that those women actually said, yes, it's okay. But, you know, even if they sort of did say something that indicated that they were okay with it, I'm kind of thinking that the request itself is so kind of unusual that one might sort of assent thinking that, and some of the women, I think, said that they thought it was a joke and they just went, you know, ha ha, sure. So, you know, I can certainly imagine that. It's just really a request that I think would leave most people in a sort of state of shock all by itself. Or, I don't know, maybe I'm terribly old-fashioned.
Well, and to be clear, I mean, just to kind of clarify, like, basically what he's done, his MO is that other comedians, or at least those are the people who have come out, or fans of his, would come to him after a show or after their shows and say, hey, you know, do you want to talk? And he would, he would bring them to his room. In some of the accounts that I've read, he may have blocked the door, but he would say, hey, do you mind if I masturbate in front of you, essentially? And then would do that. Some of the of his accusers have said that they felt that they couldn't say no, or as you said, that it was a joke. In his note, he talks about that it was inappropriate, partly because of power dynamics, that even though this is not the Bill O'Reilly or the Roger Ailes type of sexual harassment where it's somebody who is clearly subordinate in an organization. Do you think the Louis C.K. Kind of response, I mean, and you note some of the question, you know, there's oddness in it, but is it an advance, shall we say, over, say, Kevin Spacey, the Oscar-winning actor who's been accused of, you know, propositioning essentially, underage children years ago.
Right, and I think he's also accused of non-consensually touching a number of people. And I think
he's been fired more recently.
Very pushy and aggressive and berating the person for saying no. I think there's definitely a gradation. I mean, it's not masturbating in front of someone is not as bad as physically touching someone without their consent. At the same time, I mean, I would also imagine that when you have this kind of very unusual thing happening, I think many people might not know what's going to happen next. I mean, you know, you really have no idea if it's going to escalate further. So I imagine that it was an extremely uncomfortable and kind of scary experience for those women. So I think there is a kind of degree of awfulness.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, just because you're not as bad as, you know, what Harvey Weinstein is alleged to have done, which is basically, you know, serial rape and sexual coercion, doesn't mean that it's okay. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, just because shoplifting is not as bad as street robbery doesn't mean that it's an okay thing. So I think that these are the claims that we have heard against these high profile people really are pretty bad.
Can we be clear? I mean, like, you know, because this is it's a gender issue on a certain level, or it's sexual harassment, but so far all of the cases really have been against men in power, and we shouldn't lose sight of that, right? I mean, that's right.
No, that is very true. And some of those claims have come from other men, you know, as with, of course, Kevin Spacey, most notably, and there have been a couple of others. Charlie Sheen has been accused of sexually assaulting an underage actor. So, you know, in that sense, it's not strictly a gender issue in terms of female victims. It is so far directed specifically at male entertainers, producers, and so on. And, you know, I have sort of wondered if eventually we're going to have accusations leveled at women as well. So that'll be kind of interesting to see.
Why do you think this is happening now? And, you know, and we go back, I guess Bill Cosby was the first kind of big case, you know, that is clearly, you know, we didn't know it at the time, but it seemed to be the beginning of a kind of wave of this. And that goes back to 2014. Right. But, you know, and I've been thinking about this, too. You know, one of the odd things is, you know, I'm forgetting which year was the year of the woman. I think that was 1998.
Oh, that was 1992. It was Peter Hill, who testified in 1991. Yeah. Clarence Thomas confirmation.
But this seems to
and
be.
And then we have, by the way, also a high profile figure, at least one that I can think of, Bob Packwood, who was the Republican senator from Oregon, who ironically was kind of a you know, liberal feminist Republican who was pro-choice and was and had the support of a lot of women's groups. And then there was something like 26 or 27 women who came forward with accusations of groping and propositioning and,
yeah,
you know,
forced kissing. I remember there was a lot of that. Yeah. And he was sent.
Again, it wasn't sort of Weinstein level stuff. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't rape. But, you know, there was a lot of really bad behavior there. And he, I can't remember if he resigned or just didn't run for re-election. But in any case, you know, that scandal did bring him down. And it did lead to this outpouring of female activism, where we had a lot of women run, in many cases, successfully for Congress. And it was known as the year of the woman. It also kind of tied into Bill Clinton getting elected, you know, ironically, in view of what was to happen later on. And Hillary Clinton as the sort of new type of first lady, who was perceived as a kind of symbol of the you know, the new liberated first lady.
Well, that was the you vote for one, you elect one, you get two. I mean, they were co-equals in their marriage and they would be in the workplace, which I think rightly caused some hesitation among a lot of people, because when you're talking about electing somebody president, you're not, you know, I mean, you're looking at them. But that, I guess, you know, if we tag the Anita Hill testimony at the Clarence Thomas hearings as the start of this, it's been this wave has actually been building for a long time. Do you feel like, but more, you know, kind of more recently, you know, why do you, and I'm sorry, let me wind back there a bit. You know, part of it is that women started entering the workforce in serious numbers in the post-war era, really, in the 1970s. By the end of the 1980s, there was, if not, actual parity in terms of income levels or management positions. By the 90s, it was clear women were graduating college at a higher level. They were ascending into more equal ranks with men in traditionally male roles. And you can see how that parity is going to change, you know, how people act, what is allowed in the office, all of that kind of stuff. What is triggering this latest wave of, you know, and these are very serious accusations. In an odd way, what Clarence Thomas was accused of, which was making crass behaviors, bringing up pornography, et cetera. He never, apparently by Anita Hill's own testimony, he never punished her in terms of offering her, you know, promotions or salary increases. She actually worked with him. She followed him to several different positions. I mean, the stuff we're talking about now, and it's odd that it's, you know, 30 years later, and we're talking about much more serious crime. Why do you think it's taken so long for this kind of stuff to out, and why is it happening now?
Right. Well, you know, one thing that is really interesting, I was looking at the chronology of some of these really, really bad Weinstein allegations, and I noticed that some of them were actually happening in, you know, right at the time that this national conversation, and at the time that was a phrase that was very much in use, there was a, you know, national conversation on sexual harassment. We didn't have the social media, but, you know, I think people sort of underestimate, because of course we have a very short-term memory, I think people underestimate the amount of conversation that people could actually have without Twitter and Facebook. You know, there were, I mean, I was just the other day looking at some of the things, you know, from that era, and there were a lot of personal accounts by women. You know, there were women writing op-eds, you know, there were people who wrote articles based on women's accounts. There were, you know, there was conversation on TV and radio. So there were a lot of stories. And I think it's really a mistake to kind of assume that women didn't have a voice until Twitter came along.
Right. But it's clear, would you, I mean, also along those lines, I mean, the Bill Cosby stuff, I went to Temple University where he has a PhD in education, and he was, you know, he was the international ambassador essentially for Temple as the greatest living alum. His doctoral project in education was Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. You know, but in Philadelphia, I can remember, you know, and this was in the late 80s, early 90s, there were stories floating around about Bill Cosby, and Philadelphia Magazine and other outlets locally had discussed things. One of the, at least one of the accusers, a high profile accuser recently, worked at Temple. But you know, as you say, I mean, those accounts were floating around. There were blind items and gossip sheets about people like Louis C.K. from at least a few years ago, but Weinstein going back to the 90s. But it does seem that social media allows something different. And when you think of somebody like Rose McGowan, the actress who has a settlement or a reported settlement with Weinstein dating back from years ago, decades ago, she's been very active. And I mean,
right.
Does social media...
It is kind of interesting. It is interesting to note that the actual, you know, the story about Weinstein did not break on Twitter. It was broken initially by the New York Times. And of course, then Ronan Farrow did the piece for the New Yorker. And it turned out that he had actually wanted to do something for NBC. And they were really skittish about that. So, you know, really, it's funny that it was the... kind of the old legacy media, so to speak, that actually did bring the story out into the open. But at the same time, I think the difference possibly is that, you know, with the social media, it's very easy to galvanize this kind of mass outpouring of people sharing their personal experiences. And I think that is one of the things that made a difference in the snowballing of this scandal, where, you know, it's gone from Weinstein to a number of other people.
What do you make of the fact that, I mean, a lot of the people, Louis C.K. is different, but, you know, Kevin Spacey is in his late 50s. Weinstein is in his 60s. Bill Cosby was attempting a comeback.
Right.
He's in his 70s, I think, or might even be early 80s. And he had one of the most misbegotten Twitter campaigns. He was there was a Netflix series that was going to be coming out, and he asked people to make Cosby memes right as the story was breaking. So he,
talk about setting up your own downfall, really.
But these guys, I mean, like mostly they are kind of old and long in the tooth. You know, Roger Ailes was dying of cancer. Bill O'Reilly was completing a 25-year run as like the biggest figure in cable news. What do you make of the fact that, that these guys are all kind of old? Why is it that the case?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think one actual argument that I've heard is that in a way it was kind of, the fact where the act of going after these figures was facilitated by the fact that they were no longer kind of at the prime of their power. I mean, even Weinstein, ironically, he was way past his heyday in Hollywood, and he was actually attempting a comeback, ironically enough, like Cosby. In fact, I came across this The Hollywood Reporter headline, and I think from September, saying something like, "Can Harvey Weinstein manage another comeback?" And I was kind of thinking, well, I guess not. And I mean, that was a headline that really did not age well. I think that there may be something to that. I mean, I don't know if there is anything to the argument that, the behavior itself is generational. Harvey Weinstein has tried to say that, this kind of thing was acceptable in the 60s and 70s when, I first got started in the industry. I don't really think that this kind of behavior was ever acceptable. It may have been acceptable to, slap somebody on the butt in a supposedly kind of flirtatious manner, or, to make salacious jokes, or, even to proposition someone. But, the kind of behavior that he is accused of, inviting an actress up to his hotel room and, emerging from the bathroom naked and demanding sexual favors, I don't think that was ever really considered to be
although
normal.
There's that long, Hollywood and the casting couch, you hear about this in, record labels in the, in the rock or pop music industry. And again, I don't think it was ever officially considered like, okay, this is okay, but it seemed that it was more either common or acknowledged and taken for granted. Right.
So I think probably in sort of less extreme forms, but yeah. Although I think it is kind of important to know that there were even, back in the days of silent film, there were men whose careers actually were destroyed by accusations of sexual impropriety.
Right. Sure.
Errol Flynn, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, even, these were men who,
I don't know the story about Buster Keaton, and that's surprising to me. I do know Fatty Arbuckle, another. Buster Keaton was Fatty Arbuckle, who, by many revisionist accounts, was actually innocent. It's true that there were sex scandals going back then. Do you think that there has been a major sea change in kind of business or workplace etiquette? So that one of the reasons that we're not hearing about this as much with younger people, is it because the behavior has changed, or is it because, people in their 40s, say, are actually running the place, so they're protected, that these kinds of accusations, it's the same thing with Stalin. People started whispering about him right before he died. But when he was in his prime, nobody dared say anything bad.
Right. I think we have actually seen accusations against some younger people as well, like this new thing with Brett Ratner, where, Gal Gadot is now saying that she will not participate in the next Wonder Woman movie if he's involved in the project. And some of the other ones, I think certainly some of this is also directed at younger people. I don't know that it's necessarily all generational and all directed at sort of has-beens. In terms of the changes in the workplace, I think that a lot of people that I've spoken to have sort of found it really shocking to know how much of this behavior was still going on in Hollywood when, you know, people in more regular workplaces have lost their jobs for considerably lesser offenses. And I think that was kind of a wake-up call to a lot of people. And, you know, ironically, and I think, by the way, we really shouldn't underestimate the political factor in the snowballing of the scandal, which is that in this case, the right, which is usually not in the forefront of sort of pushing
Gender equality or equity,
harassment and so on. In this case, this really fits into this, right wing meme of Hollywood depravity. And of course, it allows a lot of conservative commentators to kind of chortle with glee at the people who were, the Hollywood celebrities who were grandstanding with their denunciations of Trump and his treatment of women. And now they can go like, ha-ha, well, look at what was going on in your own backyard. So I think there is that political factor as well. And I think it has contributed to the scandal snowballing the way it has.
What do you think of Trump, and the Trump tape that came out shortly before the 2016 election? Was pretty stunning, you hear reports of things, but not actual the words themselves and things. And I mean, clearly that's a contributing factor, at least in terms of...
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think, I'm going to sort of express an unpopular opinion here and say that I don't necessarily think that the tape is, as a lot of people say, an actual confession to sexual assault. Because Trump says, and I think this is, by the way, what has allowed many of his supporters to kind of discount this. I mean, Trump says a lot of stuff. I mean, he does say that when you're a star, you can do anything, you can grab women, et cetera. Trump has also said stuff like, my supporters, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they would still vote for me. No one is investigating him for, possibly having shot somebody on Fifth Avenue. So I think that is kind of an out that people had in terms of, is he talking about something that he has actually done? And of course, then we have had, a number of women come forward with what I think in most cases are quite credible accusations. I think one of the reasons, by the way, that he did manage to kind of get over that in terms of, in the election, is that he was running against Hillary Clinton, who is married to Bill and who has stood by Bill. So I think that for a lot of people, that gave them kind of an out, where they said, well, on the one hand, we have this guy who, talks in incredibly crude terms about women and who, where it looks like he actually has, grabbed and touched some women without their consent, done all this really, skeevy stuff. On the other hand, we have a woman who, has contributed to the smearing of women who came forward to accuse their husband of sexual assault. And, of course, people also brought up this other thing, this tape where she was talking about her experience as a defense attorney, where she seemed to be kind of talking very flippantly about defending a guy who had raped a, 12-year-old girl. And, of course, as we know, Trump kind of capitalized on that by bringing those women to one of the debates. And I think that really, to some extent, really defanged, so to speak, Hillary Clinton's ability to use the sexual impropriety as a kind of weapon in the campaign.
Yeah. It seemed, watching it, it did give it a generational cast of, in the sense of, you're talking about people who are all around 70 years old, and they just seem to be from from a different America almost, where, when I talk to people basically under 40, they have no memory of the Clinton presidency, and anything before kind of Bush's second term is, you might as well be talking about, Abraham Lincoln and, William Henry Harrison or something.
Yeah,
These old wizened people on stage, it just seems to be a very different world.
Oh, sure, yeah. But at the same time, I think for a lot of people who, a lot of younger people for whom that was kind of a revelation, like suddenly they were saying, well, wait a minute, you know, Hillary is supposed to be this champion of women, but, you know, here we're now learning that she did all this sort of stuff where she, you know, that really belies her, you know, believe the women kind of slogan.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's like everybody would just reject. Not, you know, you had, and in the end, you knew one of those people, either Hillary or Trump, were going to be president, but you rejected the issue because it was so muddy and it tarred both of them.
It seemed to cut both ways. But at the same time, I do think that for a lot of feminists, I think Trump's victory was sort of perceived as this huge slap in the face, not only because of the tape and not only because of, you know, what appeared to be his admission to sexual assault and all these accusations against him, but also, of course, because he defeated the woman who they thought was going to be the first female president and who seemed to be so much more qualified than he was. You know, the argument that was being made by a number of people was that, well, the mere fact that Trump, who is completely incompetent and crazy and, you know, crude and so on, was able to defeat this, you know, hugely more qualified woman itself proves that we live in a misogynist society. Now, I will say that I've never really put much stock in that argument because before he defeated Hillary, he defeated, you know, what, 15, 16 guys in the Republican primary, all of whom were also, you know, in conventional political terms, vastly more qualified than he was. So I think that that argument doesn't really quite fly. But, you know, at the same time, it's really not necessarily a fully logical thing. It's the sort of outpouring of emotion. And I think for many, you know, young women who supported Hillary, many activists, probably of both sexes. You know, Hillary's defeat was seen as this sort of this, you know, last triumph of the patriarchy, so to speak.
So let's, you know, to shift to, you recently wrote a Los Angeles Times column, which asks the question, is Weinsteining getting out of hand? And by that, you don't mean, you know, should rapists and sexual assaulters,
oh my goodness, no,
be, you know, be, yeah, be, you know, right, put, brought to justice or to public shaming or both. Rather, what you're talking about, specifically, you focus on the case of Leon Wieseltaire, who is, again, I think he's 70-something, very legendary figure in journalism. He was the longtime back-of-the-book editor of The New Republic, and he was respected for his – respected and feared for his ability to commission withering or positive reviews of new books, TV shows, et cetera. He was about to start up a new magazine, and it came out decades old, mostly, I guess, decades old, instances where he was accused of what you termed, or actually what some of his accusers called low-level lechery. How is the Wieseltaire kind of situation different than the Weinstein situation, and why is it worth – why do you think it's worth making that kind of distinction?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that certainly with Wieseltier, there was no allegation ever, for instance, that he tried explicitly, as Weinstein had done in many cases, to hold, you know, people's career advancement over their head and essentially, you know, more or less explicitly say, you know, go along with this if you want to have a career at the magazine. You know, at the same time, I will say that since I wrote that, some of the things that have come out since then, like Sarah Wildman's piece in Vox, where she talks about, you know, Wieseltier sort of unexpectedly just sort of ambushing her near the ladies' room at you know, an after work kind of hangout in a bar and suddenly kissing her on the lips and, you know, kind of making it pretty clear that he was interested in a sexual relationship. She was an intern in her early 20s. You know, he was a married, you know, editor in his 50s at the time, who was really very widely known to be this, you know, kind of gray cardinal, you know, gray eminence at the magazine, where he wasn't the editor in chief, but he was really, you know, a real powerhouse. That is a very kind of intimidating situation. And I really don't want to sound like I'm condoning that. And also, of course, Sarah Wilman also says that she went to Peter Beinart, who was the editor at the time. He supposedly reported it to Marty Peretz, and then nothing was done. And she actually found herself in a situation later where she had to, apologize to Weasel Tear for something or other, not for, reporting that incident, but I forget what it was for, but it was kind of, I can certainly see how it would be a really galling situation. I certainly do sympathize with someone who's put in that position. And I really think that, by the way, for Weasel Tear's own good, as well as Sarah Wildman's, it would have been much, much better if, either Beinart or Marty Peretz had taken him aside at that point, if nothing else, and said, we really need to make it very clear that this kind of behavior toward employees, and especially, young interns who are in a very kind of powerless position, really is not supposed to happen. At the same time, I will still say that, and I've heard a number of other women express this opinion, should we really have the sort of, career death penalty for all these very disparate offenses? Leon Weasel Tear, certainly, unlike Weinstein, is not accused of, sexually assaulting anyone. I know that there is this sort of prevailing opinion now among the kind of the activists and a lot of the social media people that an unwanted kiss is sexual assault. I don't know that I would really go that far. I mean, it's certainly grossly inappropriate in a workplace situation. I agree with that. But I think to put it on a par with a lot of this other behavior that we've heard about is really excessive. I think that it was appropriate for Weasel Tear to be publicly embarrassed by these revelations about his behavior, to suffer some kind of consequences. Should he have his career completely destroyed over this, again, sort of on the same level as Weinstein? I don't know that I agree with that. I think that there should be a kind of, there should be gradations of punishment.
Right. So, and you quote an unnamed millennial journalist in your a female millennial journalist who you say isn't inclined to cut sexual predators any slack, that she did not think a person's life should be ruined over that. Talking about the low level.
Right. I've heard the same opinion from a number of other women who were not at all sympathetic to the way that he had behaved. And, I also think that it is fair. You mentioned before that all of these accused sexual predators are male. And, as I said in my piece in the LA Times, it's certainly very, very difficult to imagine a female equivalent of Harvey Weinstein. For a variety of reasons. But I don't know. Is it possible to imagine a woman in a high level position who engages in this sort of, again, to quote that phrase, low level lechery? I've heard about this kind of thing happening.
It'll be interesting to see as women ascend to, even more equal or disparate power as they, because more women are in the workplace than men. Is it power that breeds this behavior, or is it something about men? I guess that's something that we'll see.
I think I remember reading that by the late 1990s, I think something like 10-12% of sexual harassment charges that came before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission actually were charges against women, sometimes from men, sometimes from other women. But I think that we also, and this was one of the other things that I was that I was concerned about, the kind of behavior that we're looking at. If you look at what happened in the aftermath of Anita Hill, it started with Bob Packwood resigning for, groping and forcibly kissing women and so on. And I think, no one really was at the time sympathetic to, to his situation. And I think everyone agreed that it was completely inappropriate. But then we started having all these cases. You may remember that there was a case in which a guy actually got fired for repeating to a female coworker a joke that had been on Seinfeld the night before. This was when remember when Seinfeld was had gone out with a woman named Dolores.
Right. Yes, and who's who? He didn't know her name, but he knew that her name rhymed with the name of the female anatomy. Yes.
Right. And he apparently this guy repeated this joke to somebody at work, and you know somebody took offense, and he was sort of summarily fired. There were several other cases where people lost their jobs over kind of equal. There was a guy, for instance, who lost his job, who was a supervisor at a wastewater treatment plant. I was actually looking at some of these cases last night in my book Ceasefire, which came out in 1999, which was kind of dealing with a lot of this stuff. There was a guy who lost his job for bringing to work an issue of Esquire magazine that had on its cover a photo of an actress, I can't remember which one, who was kind of unhooking her bra and looking over her shoulder in a kind of provocative way. And you know, somebody who saw this on his desk thought it was, you know, overly sexual and inappropriate in the workplace. He was fired. There were other, you know, cases where people either lost their jobs or got demoted over you know, remarks that were probably inappropriate, but that were kind of like somewhat crude
so
sexual.
How do you think the national conversation this time around is going? Because it seems to me that I've seen in a number of sites or commentators, including people who write for or are identified as, you know, very, you know, unequivocally feminist, making the kinds of distinctions that you're making here, that, you know, there's Weinstein, you know, there's Bill Cosby, there's Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, who are, you know, who have been accused credibly or have paid out on gross improprieties, if not actual physical assaults and criminal acts. And they, you know, they seem to be very conscious of not repeating the mistakes of the past, of essentially criminalizing, you know, every act of workplace banter or even occasionally inappropriate behavior, as long as it's not a continuing thing.
Some people certainly are. I mean, I will say that I was very pleasantly surprised to see Erin Gloria Ryan, with whom I, you know, formerly of Jezebel, now the Daily Beast, with whom I've sort of locked horns in the past over some of these issues, write a piece that, you know, a lot of which I agreed with, where she basically said, you know, let's not make a federal case out of every, you know, little inappropriate comment, because, you know, that will only set up a backlash. And I am glad to see that in spite of our short, you know, very short-term memory, some people do seem to be heeding the lessons of, you know, that experience. At the same time, I will say that, you know, I've certainly seen articles you know, statements that do seem to be kind of going down the same route. There was a piece by Roxane Gay in the, you know, on the op-ed page of the New York Times, basically saying, oh, you know, all men need to scrutinize every interaction that they've ever had with a woman and, you know, see if they, you know, may have overstepped the bounds or done something hurtful. And yeah, you know, I think that when you start going down that route, you're going to lose a lot of allies who are totally sympathetic to, you know, bringing down the likes of Weinstein. I've seen comments to the effect that, oh, well, you know, you in response to questions like, you know, is it still okay to flirt in the workplace? I've seen comments along the lines of, no, it's not. And, you know, women don't want that. Well, I'm thinking, you know, kind of speak for yourself. I mean, there are a lot of women who have married people that they've worked with, who have, you know, dated former or current coworkers in either short-term or long-term relationships. And, you know, there are certainly a lot of people who engage in, you know, sexual banter in the workplace. And I will add, by the way, that in terms of, because right now we're looking at a lot of things that are going on in Hollywood and, you know, in the entertainment industry in general, I think that it is kind of natural to have different standards of behavior in, let's say, the comedy industry. I mean, there was a woman, I can't remember her name right now, but she wrote a piece about sexual harassment in the comedy world. And she actually acknowledged that even though it is a real problem, it's also kind of really difficult to draw the lines because, you know, the world of comedy itself is rife with sexual humor. You know, so to say that it's inappropriate to engage in crude banter in the field of comedy really would be completely completely impossible.
Well,
I mean,
and
it's part of
the— In the L.A. Times piece, you also mentioned that there was a Mike magazine, M.I.C. magazine survey that found that, you know, millennials under people under 35 were twice as likely to have met their current partner through work as through online dating, and that other surveys talk about that. So,
yeah, and I was going to say, you know, the other thing that I find really interesting is that this kind of attitude, because I think at the time, you know, in the late 90s, a lot of people, including me, were saying that this is bringing back an almost kind of neo-Victorian view of women where, you know, to tell a sexual joke in the workplace is somehow seen as, you know, inherently offensive to women, or, you know, let's say to put up a cartoon with sexual innuendo on the wall of your cubicle. Today, we have a situation where the kind of the new feminist culture has really encouraged female kind of raunchiness. You know, we have Lena Dunham, we have, you know, Amy Schumer, who have a very kind of sexually—
Yeah, Sarah Silverman as well.
Persona, yeah. Who are, you know, routinely using extremely raunchy humor as part of their kind of stage persona, so to speak, or screen persona. So I think that it is a little kind of a little more than a little confusing to say that on the one hand, you know, we're going to have this feminist culture that really encourages this very overt female sexuality, and at the same time, we're going to say that, you know, any sort of manifestation of male sexuality in the workplace that may, in somebody's mind, cross the line. And again, obviously, we're not talking about sexual assault or, you know, even the Louis C.K. type behavior. I don't think too many people have doubts about whether that crosses the line or not. But, you know, I think it is very confusing to say that at the same time, you know, we're going to punish any kind of manifestation of male sexuality in the workplace. And I think that's a route that we should be very careful not to go down.
If I can paraphrase Camille Paglia, I'll say that, you know, for the past 30 years, everything good and bad in American society, we can pretty much blame on Madonna, right? Both female sexual empowerment, female sexual raunchiness, and confusion over gender roles, for sure.
Right. But I mean, Madonna hasn't, by the way, it's interesting that she hasn't sort of jumped on this bandwagon of
Well, she did
harassment.
Speak at the Women's March happened after, during the inauguration.
I do think that there is a kind of double standard. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that you may remember that several months ago, Lena Dunham kind of came under fire when I forget the name of the athlete that she was talking about, where she said something in a conversation with Amy Schumer in very sort of, again, very sort of raunchy terms about how she was sitting next to this athlete at a Met Gala, and she was kind of somewhat upset and amused by the fact that he didn't seem to recognize her as a sexual being at all, and was kind of confused by
and offended almost.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and it did kind of elicit a backlash, but it's kind of funny that the only reason I think that it elicited a backlash is that the athlete in question was Black. And therefore, it was cast in these, you know, racial terms of, you know, white women sexualizing Black men. And she was actually forced to apologize for that. But it did kind of leave me wondering, you know, would that, I mean, I don't think that that would have elicited the same kind of backlash if she had been talking about a white guy. So I think that there is a kind of double standard that that I think we should be wary of. And, you know, I will also say that in terms of male victims, initially, and that has kind of fallen by the wayside in the wake of, you know, Kevin Spacey and everything. But initially, when the Me Too hashtag began, there were people who were kind of actively hostile to men who were talking about their victimization. in that hashtag, and basically saying, oh, no, this is the women's moment, and you're kind of stepping on the toes of women who are talking about the sexist and, oppressive treatment that they have suffered, which I thought was really, I mean, talk about disempowering victims, because if anything, you know, and you can even sort of blame it also on patriarchal stereotypes, male victims have been even more silenced in a way than female victims, because it is seen as kind of extremely unmanly and emasculating to be a victim of sexual abuse. And I have actually wondered, given
and
that...
And, you know, that is Corey Feldman, the child actor who is still working somewhat, has both wrote a memoir about that, but has also come out recently to talk about the abuse. He claims it's systemic and it's very widespread abuse of male child actors. And he attributed
right.
Corey
and
Haim,
we
his friend's death,
like bring,
to that.
Yeah. Bring Milo Yiannopoulos into this, where remember the part of his downfall was that he talked about having been at Hollywood parties where there were, as he put it, very young boys who were kind of used for sexual purposes. And, you know, somebody the other day posted a clip that I thought was kind of interesting where Corey Feldman made these statements. He was on The View after writing this, which is, the all-female TV show. And he was kind of shouted down. Like, he was chastised for making... uncorroborated or, you know, unspecified accusations and tarnishing an industry. And I just think it's really ironic, given the sort of the gender dynamics that we're talking about now, that in that case, he was essentially kind of shouted down by four women when he tried to talk about this, the sexually abusive behavior that went on. So I would be really, I'm very, very wary of casting this in sort of gender terms of, oh, you know, this is about the patriarchy oppressing women. I mean, I do think that there is almost certainly more female sexual misconduct than we know about. And I mean, if there was this kind of initial lack of sympathy for male victims who spoke out about being victimized by other men, I mean, I can only imagine if a guy had come out to say that, you know, he was sexually abused by a woman, he'd probably be seen as trying to, you know, undermine the purpose of the Me Too hashtag. So I think the gender politics, to me, are a little bit alarming.
Well, we will have to leave it there, but I want to thank you, Kathy Young, Reason contributor, Newsday columnist, contributor to many publications. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.